Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Jonathan Rowson, the director of the Social Brain Centre at the RSA, and he's here to talk to us today about the Social Brain Project. Hello, Jonathan. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi, Barry. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah. Can you start by telling us something of your background and how you became involved with the RSA?
Okay. Well, I was born in Aberdeen in 1977. Major events included becoming diabetic at the age of six, learning chess at the age of five. Chess was a big part of my childhood, I suppose, so much so that I managed to get entry into Oxford through good exam results at school.
Yeah.
But I took a year out to play chess first, and then I studied politics, philosophy, and economics for 3 years, mostly in philosophy.
Yeah.
And I took another 3 years or so to play chess. I became a grandmaster. I wrote a few books about the game.
Yeah.
Did various teaching and writing pieces of work. And then I was a bit of a loss what to do, and there was a master's degree at Harvard called Mind, Brain, and Education, which was broadly about applying the findings of neuroscience and cognitive science to educational practice.
Yeah.
And I went there for a year and did that. And then I came back, you know, hoped that would sort of solve my problems and teach me what to do with my life. But it wasn't so clear. So I came back and played a bit more chess, a couple more years. And then I was becoming a dad. I was tired of traveling so much, and also keen to contribute to the world more generally than just through the game.
Yeah.
And a job came up at the RSA. Back then it was in the Connected Communities Project, which is a project about social networks and sort of utilizing social networks, particularly in deprived communities. But it was very clear from quite an early stage that although I was quite well suited to that piece of work, and I even wrote the first report on it, my real interests were much more in sort of the foundations of human behavior. And I had a slightly more philosophical cast of mind. So when the Social Brain Project sort of leader, as he was then, left the RSA, I took on that sort of mantle. And in amongst there, I forgot to mention, somewhere in there I did a PhD. That was roughly between coming back from Harvard and joining the RSA. I spent about 3 years playing chess, but I also spent time completing my PhD, which was at Bristol, supervised by Guy Claxton.
Yeah.
Some of your listeners might know.
Yeah.
He's quite a good middle way kind of fellow, I think. That was on the subject of what it means to become wiser. We speak a lot about becoming brighter or smarter, but I was curious to know whether there's any sort of developmental models or constructs of wisdom whereby it gives you some sort of path quality to the attempt to grow as a human being.
Yeah.
What does it mean to become wiser? And that took up a good 3 to 4 years of my time. And then I joined the RSA, and kind of the rest is history, I guess.
Okay. So what is the RSA Social Brain Centre? How did it come about, and what are its aims and objectives?
Okay, well, to back up slightly, the RSA as a whole, for those who know it, kind of these things go without saying, but for those who don't, it's an abbreviation for the Royal Society of Arts. It's an organisation that's about 260 years old. It was founded very much in the spirit of the Enlightenment. It was about, bringing ideas to bear on pressing social problems. And that's still very much our position. We have a kind of ideas platform that we're best known for, public events and debates. RSA Animates have become very famous.
Yeah.
We also have a large body of members called Fellows. There's 27,000 or so of them. And then we have our kind of research function, which I'm part of. And within that, we have different groups. So we have a group in education and design. I mentioned Connected Communities already, and a few others, and Social Brain was one of them. And the genesis of it was really, it was principally from Matthew Taylor, who's our chief executive here. He worked with Tony Blair in 10 Downing Street while Blair was in power. And I think when he came into this role, he was looking for, you know, he's kind of a fairly instinctive third-way thinker as a result of working in that government. And I think he was looking for a sort of foundation or a sort of understanding that would allow him to frame the work program for the organization as a whole.
Yeah.
And around the same time, Thaler and Sunstein published a book on Nudge. It was a sort of popular liking for neuroscientific research. And in that context, he devised the Social Brain Project, as it was then. He created a steering group of neuroscientists and cognitive scientists, behavioral economists, a few anthropologists, one or two people in marketing, various people interested in behavior change, broadly conceived, to sort of think about, you know, rebuilding the foundations of human nature. So if the default folk psychological assumption in the street, or even in Whitehall, if you like, is that human beings are a certain kind of creature that is rational, predictable, largely self-interested, and so forth, and those axioms prove to be at best shaky, if not downright mistaken, then the question is, what do you replace them with? And that was really the space into which the Social Brain Project was born.
Yeah.
It was rethinking that. And then it was about practical projects that might be spun out of that.
Okay. So human nature is the broad domain, and presumably behavior change is your broad concern then, is it?
That's right. So both of those terms, of course, beg a lot of questions. I mean, I remember someone saying there's no such thing as human nature, but there are human cultures. And, you know, it depends on where you are in this philosophically. Clearly, there's no, you know, Steven Pinker's book on the blank slate was quite a good way of debunking the idea that we're born as a completely blank slate that is merely formed through experience. On the other hand, some believe that the sort of genetic and other sort of physical predeterminants have a relatively minimal impact on who we become, and the social structure and cultural influences are much more important, early relationships and so forth.
Yeah.
But what's obvious to anyone who's a bit, you know, measured about these things is that they're all relevant. And the issue then becomes not so much human. The challenge then is that when you say human nature, people think you're talking about something fixed. But what you find is the sort of core component of human nature is its malleability.
Yeah.
And so that's really the idea we're working with. It's sort of, it is about human nature in a sort of axiomatic way, but those are sort of elastic axioms that we can shape according to sort of social, cultural, and political influences as well. And then I suppose the behavior change dimension, that was a way of giving it a bit of practical edge. It's like, well, okay, that's all very well. We think of human nature, great. But, you know, they do that in philosophy and psychology departments up and down the country and elsewhere too. What are you doing that's different? And we were thinking, well, look, we believe that if you get people to start thinking about this stuff, they may actually behave differently as a result. If you come to know yourself as a different creature from the one you thought you were, perhaps you're more inclined to change your life. You know, you're more inclined to see why you're doing what you're doing and begin to think about how to do it differently.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. Just having a look at your site, you seem to have filtered these concerns into three broad strands: habits, attention, and decisions. Could you expand a bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, that framing is a few years past now. It's still there because it's still quite useful as a way of, when people say, well, what's your work about? If you say behavior, it still begs a lot of questions. If you say human nature, it begs a lot of questions. By saying decisions, habits, and attention, we're trying to give a bit more texture.
Yeah.
So decisions obviously are about, you know, the daily imponderables and choices we face as consumers, as citizens, as family members. And then there's a lot of sort of intellectual ammunition to be brought to bear to make sense of how those decisions are made, what the main influences on them are. And people have typically assumed that that's reason and rationality that's brought to bear. But increasingly it feels like social influences, social norms, environmental contexts, choice architectures, broadly the situation or the context, various other factors are brought to bear on why we decide in the way we do. And reason is often a kind of post hoc rationalization, rather than the thing that generates the decision. Habits are more about recognizing our deep automaticity. There's a wonderful paper by Barg and Chatran a few years ago called The Unbearable Automaticity of Being. really, our emphasis on habit is about bringing people's attention just how much of what we do is a function of unconscious, automatic conditioning, mostly. And some of that is highly adaptive. It's not to say it's all wrong, but a great deal of what spiritual practice is about is trying to wake up from that conditioning, from that automaticity. So by drawing attention to habit, we're saying, look, let's problematize the fact that we're these creatures of habit. but at the same time recognize we need a certain degree of habituation to function. And then finally, attention is where we sort of try to carve a little bit of a new niche. Some people describe the impact of the internet on the economy as creating an attention economy. And the attention economy is broadly, you know, people trying to get stuff in front of your eyes and your mind so that you'll behave differently as a consumer. And that can be everything from an email to an advert. But we want some people to have more resistance to these things, so that, again, they're not automatically swayed into buying or behaving in a certain way.
Yeah.
But they have a little bit of control of their own attention, so they can see it happening in real time and have a degree of autonomous control over that. And of course, that tapped into the interest in mindfulness, which was incipient then and growing in Western context, but is now really becoming a bit more mainstream and something we're working with a bit more now.
Yeah, I did an interview recently with Claire Kelly of the Mindfulness in Schools project.
Right.
And this seems really to be taking off now. What are your thoughts on the UK's old parliamentary group on mindfulness?
I think it's very encouraging. I think anyone who knows Parliament knows that all party parliamentary groups are not the, you know, the hotline to the Prime Minister. They are places for discussion, consideration, for getting clarity about what the key issues are and what needs to be resolved to bring it to bear on policy. But it is very much a kind of we have arrived moment. This is, you know, mindfulness has been taught to about 85 peers and MPs in the House of Parliament. And the APPG is a kind of forum whereby that critical mass of interest in Parliament can be brought to bear so that people can actually think in a more critical way about what kind of evidence would we need, for example, for the Department of Health to make mindfulness the first port of call for GPs when they're doing their training into how to deal with mental health conditions in their practices.
Yeah.
So it's promising, it's nascent, I'm encouraged by it, but it's very much a first step on a long road.
Yeah, okay. Now, your experience of working in these areas has enabled you to draw up some working assumptions that underpin your approach. Could we just go through these? For example, the first one, we cannot change ourselves without changing each other. Could you expand a little bit on that?
Sure. So this arises from the conventional critique of behavior change, which is that it's all about the individual, and it's a kind of selfish endeavor about it's all the responsibility of the person. And if they change, somehow nothing else changes. Social and political structures remain the same, and therefore what's the point?
Yeah.
And really, that's belied by our understanding of the influence of social norms and social networks. When you change your behavior, I don't want to give a false sort of quantity on this, but we know that you definitely have some impact on the people nearest and dearest to you.
Yeah.
You have some impact on those who are a little bit further away from you, and a little bit more of a ripple effect on those down the line in those networks. So the idea is that, you know, really when you change yourself, it doesn't end there. You don't know where your influence ends because we're all embedded in these social networks where social norms, you know, spread and proliferate.
Okay, so it's not 1+1, it's 1+2 or 3 then.
Or it's more one, you know, well, it depends again in mathematics now, but it's more sort of exponential than people realize.
Yeah.
It's realizing that if you take, you know, there's all this stuff about you can't change the world without changing yourself, or the famous Tolstoy quote about everyone thinks of changing the world, but no one thinks about changing themselves. It's a way of saying, look, it's not selfish to try and change your own behavior.
Yes.
It's actually one of the most socially adaptive things you can do and socially beneficial things you can do.
Yes.
Because once you understand your own influence as somebody embedded in the social network, your framing of what it means to change yourself changes. Because what you're really changing is a key kernel, a key node in a much larger network.
Yeah. I go quite regularly on retreats, and there is a perception now and again that it's seen as narcissistic or navel-gazing, but I find that by doing that, I can actually re-engage with the world in a lot more effective way.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, for anyone who's experienced that, you know that the quality of your interaction with others is a key component, not only of your well-being, but also of your contribution, whatever it may be. And therefore, the question is, well, what are you bringing to bear? I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh who said, the quality of our actions are a direct function of the quality of our being. And I think that means that what do you do to improve the quality of your being? Some would say that's certain forms of practice. But even if it's certain daily habits of reflection or discussion with other people, the key is not to take it for granted, and also not to see it as self-indulgent, because the idea of an individual self that is completely autonomous is basically an illusion. We're part of a bigger organism. We just have to kind of remind ourselves of that on a regular basis.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to the next one. Complexity is more often the solution than the problem.
Right, so I don't know if you've seen the rivers, boats on the River Thames, but they have these, I think KPMG is the company, it's called Cutting Through Complexity. And this is a conventional idea that really what people need is more simplicity in their lives. And all this complex stuff, oh, it's so complex, blah, blah, blah. But actually, in my experience, the capacity to complexify is a great asset. You just need to realize when it's adaptive and when it isn't, when it's helpful and when it's not. There's a lovely quote by Oliver Wendell Holmes. I think it says, I would not give my fig for my life for the life on this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side. In other words, you know, there's a difference between a kind of simplicity that is really simplistic and a kind of simplicity that is pure and lucid and arises from complexity. Yep. So a good example of that might be the equation E equals MC squared, which is sounds simple and people know it and it has a ring to it and it's part of our kind of cultural, semiotics. But crucially, it's bounded in deep science and a great deal of theoretical underpinning. So that's what I mean by complexity being an asset. You have to go beyond simplistic understandings to a much more complex understanding of things and then try and emerge on the other side. The other way of framing it is that it's grounded in developmental psychology, which broadly argues that human development is a process of progressive complexification of your mind and your consciousness. And that really, the function of complexification there is your capacity to hold multiple perspectives in mind and actually work with them, rather than just holding them constant, but really begin to integrate them, but also discriminate among them. So you can discriminate and integrate in a way that's seamless and productive and fluent. And that's the kind of complexity I'm talking about. It's not about obscuring things. It's not about being complicated needlessly. It's about growing into the fullness and the wholeness of things and doing that with courage so that you can emerge on the other side saying, I tried my best to really make sense of what's going on there.
To dare greatly.
I think so. But don't dwell on it forever. You know, don't get so lost in the complexity you never come out again.
Okay.
The challenge is to get to the simplicity on the other side.
Yeah. Okay, the next one. It is better to be reasonable than rational.
So this is actually, I owe this to Ian McGilchrist, whom I believe you've spoken to before.
Yeah.
In his book, The Master and His Emissary, which is a wonderful book, he raises a distinction somewhere, and he says that it's actually a distinction in virtually every language between reason and rationality. And it goes back to the etymological roots, and you can find it throughout. And he says, although this doesn't show that it's therefore a pattern of our thinking and our potentially our brains even, it does indicate it, it is suggestive of that. And crudely, the difference is this, that reason is broadly contextual, holistic, systemic, somewhat intuitive, very sensitive to the particularities of a given situation, mindful of, you know, the recent past and the near future. And it's very much embedded in a whole context. So on Ian's sort of model, it's very much a kind of right hemispheric perspective.
Yeah.
But in terms of rationality, that's much more like what your hardcore theoretical economists do. Your hardcore theoretical economists may be extremely rational because they create a model and they follow the principles of that model to the nth degree. But they're not obviously being reasonable. You know, they can say, they don't realize that what's true in one context may not apply so well to another. So that's not to caricature, you know, economists, because a lot of them are very thoughtful about these axioms. But the point is that there's a difference between a sort of holistic reasonableness, which is about seeing things in the round, and a kind of hardened rationality, which is much more about applying a sort of algorithmic way of thinking when it's not appropriate because it's out of context.
Yep. So how does this tie in with your the work you did with Guy Claxton and wisdom?
Quite directly, in a way, because I think a huge amount of wisdom is very much about seeing beyond the rationality towards the reason. I didn't frame it in those terms, and I would hesitate to do that too explicitly now. But I think what's valuable about wisdom when you experience it. And that was quite an important part of my thesis. It wasn't about what is it at a purely theoretical level. It's what does it feel like to have been in the presence of it or to have felt it within oneself.
Yeah.
And it's often accompanied by feelings of lightness and a feeling of sort of dissolution of the ego and a feeling of great charm and love even. And what those things don't arise from formulas. They arise from a certain quality of attention and a certain discernment that's very, very intensely sensitive to the myriad of different variables in a given situation. And I, in my thesis, I have lots of different stories that try to bring that point to bear, to try to illustrate that idea. So one I can share now that might help to make sense of it. I don't think it speaks to reasonable and rational directly, but I begin the thesis by mentioning it. It's a story of Gandhi getting on a train when he was still in South Africa. And of course, in those days, the trains were much bigger with ladders to get on them and so forth. And as he's getting on the train, one of his sandals slips off. And the train's moving away very fast, so he doesn't have time to collect it. But as soon as he gets onto the train, he throws his other sandal down to be next to that one, so that whoever finds the initial sandal has a second pair and actually a functional pair to wear.
Brilliant.
And what's amazing about this is that, you know, it's a relatively minor act in the scheme of things. But whenever I relate this to people as an example, they'd all say how wonderful. But they'd also say, look, I would never have done that in the heat of the moment. I would have thought about it 10 minutes later, maybe, when the train's further down the track and I can't do anything about it. Or I would have thought about it if you'd asked me the question of what's the best thing to do in the situation. But I couldn't do it in the here and now. And for me, a great quality of wisdom in those who have it, and it's not just about having it, because some who don't have it all the time can show it in certain contexts, is that quality of right action in the moment,
yeah,
which is a Buddhist notion. But in that situation, it's being ready, willing, and able when the situation arises to do whatever is appropriate and helpful.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I was getting at with wisdom, through those kind of examples.
Just another, I don't know if you're familiar with this story as well. Apparently when Gandhi was being shot, he had a second or so to realise that it was happening, but he had the presence of mind to put his hands together and say his mantra.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think he said Om Ram or something like that.
Yeah.
They capture that in the film, although funnily enough he says, oh God, in the film, because it's for a Western audience. But yeah.
Okay, the next one, we've touched on this quite a bit, but we can maybe just summarise it. Paying attention is good for you.
Right, so yeah, attention is what we're told to pay in classes at school. And so you get this pay attention injunction that has a negative balance to it, which is a bit unfortunate, because paying attention is actually, when you come to your senses and do it, you find it enormously rewarding usually. We're not particularly attentive by nature. We're very easily distracted.
Yeah.
And yet when we manage to find the awareness and sort of presence of mind to come back to our senses and pay attention to what's going on, the rewards are usually, you know, more effective action, but also a degree of well-being. So that's what I was getting at there.
Okay. If we want new habits, we should work with our habitats.
Yeah, so this is partly wordplay, but I've always quite liked this notion. We don't speak about human beings as living in habitats much. You know, we speak about animal habitats and destroying habitats and so forth. But if you think about it, we all have our habitats. You know, we have our behaviors thoroughly constrained and circumscribed by the format of the furniture and buildings and streets and cars and whatnot around us,
yes,
such that we don't even notice it. We're in a habitat, and what I like about the wordplay there is that, you know, the habitat is that which propagates the habits, if you like. The habitat is that which shapes our behavior at a very habitual level.
Yes.
So the idea is, if you want to change a habit, don't just tell the person you've got a bad habit, go and change it. Ask, how is your habitat reinforcing that habit and bringing it to bear?
Yeah.
If you have a television in every room and you want to watch less TV, it's not going to be that easy. If you want to exercise more, and your only form of exercise you like is running, but you're nowhere near a space where it's pleasant to run, you need to think about that.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, if you want to eat less, but you work next to Dunkin' Donuts, you know, it's these kind of things. It's about realizing that our environmental constraints are very significant.
Yeah.
And then if you want to change your habits, you need to first of all realize that you live in a habitat, and then start thinking about what can I do to shape the habitat so that I get the habits I want.
Yeah. I think people often have quite an absolute view about free will or willpower, but this perspective can really challenge, really, can't it?
I hope so. That's the aim. I mean, it's like this, we have a certain amount of freedom. And there are moments where we come back to the system and sort of retweak it, realign it, and reconfigure it in certain ways so that we have that much more scope to grow a bit more awareness. And ideally, that's an iterative, cumulative process that goes on throughout our lifespan so that we gradually grow in awareness. But of course, it doesn't always happen that way. You can get lost in your job and your family and never come out again.
Right. The final one of these assumptions is the brain is a stimulant.
Yeah, so that's kind of my own, and that arose from a report I wrote early on in this job called Transforming Behavior Change, which was subtitled Beyond Nudge in New Romania. And there I begin by asking, since I was directing the Social Brain then project, now Center, the question is, well, what do we mean by social brain? And I said, well, the brain is social in two distinct senses. One is the sense in which we evolve through and for human relationships, and a great deal of our brain power is there to track social relationships and form them and make use of them. And also that we're built for empathy and mind reading and also to negative effects too, manipulation and so forth. But the second form of social brain was in some ways more interesting. It was the idea that the brain is a shared reference point, a bit like the weather. And when I gave a few popular talks early on, I used to speak about the brain being the new weather in terms of a conversational, talking point. Because the reason you ask people about, speak about the weather is that you can be absolutely sure it's something you have in common.
Yeah.
And there aren't many things like that, but the brain is a bit like that. Not your brain or my brain, but the brain. And I thought the brain is social in that sense, that we share it as a common reference point, as a way of negotiating conversations about human behavior and human nature. And therefore, it's a stimulant in that sense that when you bring the brain into the conversation, some hardened people get very cynical and skeptical, but those who are not feeling threatened tend to get quite animated, because they realize that what's in discussion is something that is hugely important, in which everyone has a stake, and everyone has an opinion. So it was that was the sense in which the brain is stimulant.
Oh, I like that. Okay, a recent initiative of the social brain has been an examination of how new scientific understandings of human nature might help us to reconceive the nature and value of spiritual perspectives, practices and experiences. How's that been going, and what insights have you gained from this?
Okay, well, it's been going on now for about a year, maybe slightly more, a bit more actually. And where do I begin? First of all, why do this at all? So my impression is, and I'm not sure about yours, but the public understanding of spiritual matters is not very developed. It feels as though, there are certain niche places where people have very rich discussions about important questions of the meaning of life and spiritual practices one can do to develop oneself. How does one grow into compassion? What does real transformation mean? How do we get our sense of awe and wonder? What does it mean to be fully alive? And how do we feel that vitality more regularly? What is it worth devoting my life to? Really big existential questions.
Yeah.
Why don't we think about death more often? Questions like this, which, where are the forums for those things? Now, traditionally, of course, that was served by religion. To a large extent, or at least should have been. But religion, for many, has become a kind of toxic asset in a way. It's some are still willing to either adhere to the religion wholesale or have a critical engagement with it in some way. Others, though, feel too scarred by it and don't really want anything to do with it. And one of the places this project began was, in my view, there's a kind of silent majority. Maybe not a big majority, but I'd say around half the population would struggle to really give a description of their spiritual position in any of the terms that are made available to them regularly.
Yeah.
So if you say, are you an atheist? Well, not really. Are you agnostic? Well, it kind of depends on what you mean, but not really. That doesn't really do it for me either. But I'm kind of culturally Christian, but I'm not really Christian. And I read a lot of Buddhism, but I'm not really Buddhist. I don't really do enough meditation, blah, 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 blah. Where this arose was, look, does social brain perspective, rethinking human nature, have anything useful to bring to bear to these questions about why we struggle to talk about these things? And one of the reasons you come across is that we're fixated on this idea of doctrinal belief, which, as you highlighted earlier, is really only one very small aspect of religion. But it's often the cohesive factor. The shared belief is quite important for getting people into the same room.
Yeah.
And getting them to do the same rituals and sharing the same volunteering and so forth. So it's not trivial. It does matter a bit what people think about the nature of reality and the ethics entailed in that.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, that barrier shouldn't preclude all of the other great things that religion is meant to bring with it. And nor should they necessarily be concomitant with all of the baggage and difficulties that religion brings. So the word spiritual is a little bit forsaken and a little bit nebulous, and maybe overused by certain marketing departments to sell things. But I don't think we have a particularly good replacement for it. So I thought, well, what can we do to sort of bring social brain perspective to bear on the spiritual or spirituality in a way that has some public traction and can speak to how this might be used or made sense of better in public debate? And there are various ways of doing that. But if you take, for example, habits that I mentioned earlier and think in terms of spiritual practices, a great many people go to meditation courses but then stop the practice when the kind of proxy sangha that was built up for the teaching dissolves. They lose the group and they lose the commitment device to help them to keep doing it.
Yeah.
Because there are no institutional forums to support it. So what does social brain have to say about that and how important that is? When you think of automaticity, a great deal of spirituality is about really growing in awareness and breaking down automaticity. So I forget, I think it's, I don't know his work very well, but a friend of mine speaks about, is it Gurdjieff maybe, who speaks about really the whole spiritual process is about waking up. And really most of us are unconscious most of the time, kind of sleepwalking through our lives. And so we speak a little bit about that. And then there's also things about research on post-traumatic growth, which says that those who have had a serious illness or a close brush with death often live a radically different life afterwards. You know, they speak about, you know, better relationships, clarity of purpose, all of these things because they had a brush with death. Which is really ironic when you think about it, because, you know, it's not like we don't know we're going to die anyway. But somehow it's almost like we need the second warning before we really live the life that we think we should be living. And that grows out of research about regrets of the dying and so forth. So, I mean, we've had 3 public events already and 3 private events. We're having a 4th public event later this month, which is actually on death, on why don't we talk about death more, which sounds very cheery, but actually, you know, I think it's an important thing to speak about and can be done without being too gloomy. And then there'll be 2 more public events, there'll be another private event, and there'll be a final report, and that's all got to happen by September. So I'm going to be doing that as well as doing some work on climate change. So I'm going to be busy, but that's the plan, yeah.
Well, look forward to seeing the report when it comes out.
Sure.
What I find really encouraging, Jonathan, is that both our endeavours, the Social Brain and the Middle Way Society, share numerous departure points. The work of Ian McGilchrist on the brain hemispheres, Lakoff and Johnson's thesis of embodied meaning, Daniel Kahneman's work on cognitive biases, and the importance of mindfulness, balance and integration. Have you come across similar convergence in other projects?
There is some. I mean, we get a lot of very supportive emails saying, we like what you do, and how can we be involved, and so forth. And many of them, we can't really respond to meaningfully, because we don't have the capacity, really.
Yeah.
And also because RSA's function is partly research and partly change in the world, but it's partly thought leadership. So part of what we're doing is just kind of holding these ideas and examining them publicly so that others can, you know, put them to work in their own way. But certainly we get a lot of interesting feedback from everyone from the commercial sector, people working on behavior change to get people to, you know, purchase differently. A lot of environmental groups interested in our work on climate change. A lot of people very interested in our message that climate change is not just for environmentalists. A lot of people not particularly religious or even spiritual who like our work on spirituality and think it's quite brave. A lot of people use that word, actually. Yeah. Brave, courageous, and so forth. As if it was kind of taboo to even talk about these things. So I'm kind of glad for that. And then we did some work on education earlier this year, which was about applying behavioral economics to, you know, particularly classroom teaching, but more generally, how do you close the socioeconomic attainment gap so that poorer kids from poorer neighborhoods play on a level playing field with those who are better off? And in all cases, there tends to be three different responses. One is people who really get what we're trying to do and give a very enthusiastic response who try to work with us. People who don't really seem to get it, but like the sound of it, and then give a kind of, you know, thumbs up. We're a bit wary about their enthusiasm because we feel as though they might have misconstrued it. And then there are those who are quite harshly critical because they are very threatened by the idea that beginning with human behavior and human nature might somehow subsume other concerns relating to structural inequality or political action and so forth. And we've never been about that. I mean, in our writings, we're always quite clear that this is in addition to, not instead of, other interventions. And it's partly about rethinking the axioms, but those axioms are always sit alongside other axioms of a more social, cultural, political, or economic nature. So, there's been a lot of sort of generic enthusiasm, not all of which we managed to develop.
My final question, Jonathan, what is your understanding of the middle way and how does it relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, the expression itself reminds me of what I know of Buddhism. And it's often used in its traditional forms to contrast different approaches to, in religious language, you know, the approach towards enlightenment, but in more secular language, human development and growth. And that's between a kind of austere asceticism, which is, you know, giving up on the world, trying to introspect to the degree that you give up the world and try to grow in that way. And the other, which is that you somehow indulge fully in the world and all the sensual pleasures and sort of material pleasures it brings. And Buddhism sort of realizing that you don't need to do either. In fact, it's a mistake to do either. Because neither will give you what you seek. And that actually what you need is a more fruitful integration of the two so that you can actually live your life more fully aware, more fully conscious of who you are and what you're trying to do. That enjoys the pleasures of the world, but recognizes the limits of those and sees that there is great insight in seeing beyond the pleasures, but it's important not to sort of be a sort of killjoy in the process. So that's where I traditionally came across it, but it has wider application. I mean, the third way in politics connects to it. But in general, with virtually most public debates, is a really annoying binary in virtually every discussion between an extreme position on one side and on the other, or actually a very moderate position on one side that's then met with an extreme position on the other.
Yeah.
Either way, you get this sort of annoying dialectic that doesn't really reach the synthesis.
Yeah.
In some ways, the middle way is a way of saying, let's more often, more clearly, more loudly, more convincingly, bring to bear that sort of more discerning perspective that says most points of view have some good in them. But to say that is not to endorse wholesale the broader package that they may come in. And we need to have the kind of courage and intellectual nimbleness required to see our way through different forms of knowledge, different bodies of evidence, different forms of practice, and pay for ourselves intellectual and cultural resources that we can actually use to live fuller lives and better lives for ourselves and others.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Jonathan. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today.
No pleasure, you too. Thanks very much.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.